This Hedge School series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers. Editor Tommy Graham here with the latest History Ireland Hedge School. Today I'm joined by Terence Dooley, Professor of History at Maynooth University and Director of the Centre for the Study of Historic Irish Houses and Estates, to talk to us about his latest book, Burning the Big House, The Story of the Irish Country House in a Time of War and Revolution. And that's just been published by Yale University Press. Terence, you're very welcome to the Hedge School. Now, Terence, you have cornered the market in scholarship on the big house, I think it could be said. And I'm thinking in particular about your Decline of the Big House, published back in 2001. So why did you decide to write this particular book?
First of all, Tommy, thanks very much for the invitation to join the Hedge School itself. The Decline of the Big House was published just over 20 years ago now, Tommy. And one of the chapters in it, chapter 7, was devoted to the burning of big houses. At the time when I started researching this particular topic, I mean, like everybody else, I had only faint notions of what it was all about. But when I'd finished a chapter and finished a book, I realized that there was a great deal more there that had to be elucidated. And so for the last 20 years, I've been dipping in and out of this when I've been, you know, working on a variety of other projects at the same time. And of course, then we were coming to the decade of centenary, so it seemed to be a very appropriate time to sit down and think about this more seriously. And that was helped by the fact that there has been this huge release, as you know, of a variety of new primary sources that have been used to very good effect by historians of the revolutionary period, but also which, you know, helped very much to illuminate many of the areas that, you know, appeared in that chapter 7 that I hadn't, you know, the depth of sources to do. And, you know, we're not only talking about Bureau of Military History material, IRA pension files and so on, but we're also talking about the digitization of newspapers, which has been a huge benefit to historians of the whole period, let alone something as specific as the burning of big houses. So in summary, therefore, I mean, it's something that I had been thinking about for a long time. The fact that the sources had become available, and secondly, more or less to coincide with the decade of centenaries.
Okay, Terence, let's get on to the subject at hand here. What do you mean by a big house, precisely?
Yeah, well, in The Decline of the Big House, I essentially define it as the country residence, the primary country residence of a landlord on an estate of at least 500 acres in size, part of which was rented out to tenant farmers. And 500 acres seems to be, you know, the general acreage accepted as the minimum for a landlord. And in the case of this book, it's more specifically targeted towards the aristocracy. And the acreage that I chose there, very much based on David Cannadine's definition of aristocracy, is 2,000 acres. And the reason for zoning in on aristocracy, but not exclusively on aristocracy, in this book is that, first of all, the estate records pertaining to the aristocracy have had a higher rate of survival than those of the minor gentry. But secondly, because the majority of houses that were burned would actually fall into that category.
And how many are we talking about, Terence, roughly speaking?
Yeah, interesting, because there hasn't, as far as I know, been, you know, a definitive mapping of country houses using specific definition. So probably in the 19th century, we're talking about in the region of 4,500 to 5,000 houses in existence. By 1906, under a return of untended lands and mansions in Ireland, it maps only about 1,600 houses, which raises the very interesting question as to whether or not the impact of everything that had happened in between, let's say from the Great Famine, and specifically through the passing of the Land Acts, the revolutionary 1903 Wyndham Land Act that resulted in that massive transfer of land ownership, whether that had an impact on the number of houses in existence in Ireland by 1906. And when I say in existence, I'm talking about that are still resided in by the families.
So you're talking about 1,500 roughly by 1906. Now, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit here because how many were burned? We'll come back to the motivation circumstances.
Yeah.
In the revolutionary period, how many were burned then?
Roughly speaking, Tom, we're looking at 300 houses, right? In my first mapping back in 2001, I came up with a figure of just under 80 for the War of Independence and just over 190 for the Civil War. Now, some years later, James S. Donnelly Jr. Published a very important article in Era Ireland, which he questioned this figure. But Professor Donnelly had actually recorded a number of suburban villas as well on the outskirts of Cork City. Now, strictly speaking, I wouldn't define those as country houses. He opened up, another very important avenue of research. But I still went back this time around to recount. It's a work, I would say, in progress. I would say, yes, there were more burn than I originally enumerated. So this time around, I'd say there's over 100, 120 or so during the War of Independence, but roughly the same number during the Civil War.
So it's an even divide, although the Civil War.
No. It's not an even divide. There are
two
far
to one.
More
sorry, maths is bad here.
Yeah, there are far more houses burned during the Civil War than were burned during the War of Independence.
I want to come back to that later in our discussion. Right now, yeah. I was curious as to why you have two chapters in this book on the Great War, right?
Which yes.
doesn't seem to be part of this topic, at first glance. But explain yourself.
The book is entitled "During War and Revolution," right? So, I've taken the long span of 1879 to 1923 or so, and certainly the land war and everything that happens from 1879 to the passing of the Wyndham Land Act in 1903 is very important.
But can I just come in?
Sorry,
just started to cross you there because. I suspect that many of our listeners may be under the impression, right, that the land war was settled, the land question was settled by this stage, by the Wyndham Land Act, by the Birrell Land Act of 1908, right?
Yeah.
Now, that's not the case, according to you, in this book.
No, and this is something that I've been, delving into and arguing for quite some time. The land war, which ultimately results in the 1881 Land Act, then leading on to a series of other land acts, and the transfer of land ownership that takes place between 1881 and the last of the British Land Acts passed for Ireland in 1909, is of course hugely significant. And by the outbreak of the Great War, we're probably looking at 80% of land having been transferred from landlords to tenants. But that doesn't mean that the land question was solved. Because what continued was the pressure on the land because of the extent of congestion. Now, generally speaking, congestion tends to be seen to be a west of Ireland problem. But in fact, very high proportions of farms throughout the whole of the country were under what would be defined as an uneconomic or unviable level. According to the Irish Land Commission in the 1920s, this was about 23 acres of good to middling land. So you have this huge problem in relation to small farms. You also have a problem in relation to the landless who continue to look for redress of their situation, as well as the agricultural laborers. So the land question remains a very potent political subject in Ireland long after the Wyndham Land Act of 1903.
Can I just come in with a related question here? And this might go back to the origin of these big houses, right? The result of the plantations of the 16th, 17th centuries, essentially. I presume I'm correct in that.
Yeah.
So they've always been associated with the conquest, right? Now, the rhetoric of, say, even the most moderate of home rule politicians, you know, the late 19th, early 20th century, was that home rule would represent the quote-unquote undoing of the conquest.
Yeah.
And equally, the land question was similarly framed, that it was all about undoing the conquest rather than being about land per se. You follow me? So
yes.
Like, where do you fit into that discussion?
Well, first of all, again, going back to the land war, right? I mean, this is the point where I would say, you know, much focus is centered upon the country house as a symbol of colonial oppression. And you'll get that from platforms, political platforms or land league platforms up and down the country, right? So the idea by 1917 or so, when the last phase of land agitation or the land war breaks up, is that the lands that are still retained by those who reside in these country houses should be redistributed amongst the people, the small uneconomic holders, the landless, and so on. And therefore, the rhetoric that is propagated by Sinn Féin and indeed by TD subsequently in the Dáil from the 1920s onwards is very much based on this idea of undoing the conquest, reversing Cromwell's policy, right?
But they weren't, so, in the sense that the land wasn't given back to the original owners. Do you know what I mean? In other words, there's a dichotomy here between this idea of undoing the conquest.
Yeah.
And land for the people. They're not the same thing at all.
But who were the original owners,
yeah,
Tommy? I mean, all the land acts could effectively do was transfer the land from the ownership of the landlords to the tenants who were occupying farmers or occupying tenants at the time of the passing of the legislation. But what the 1906 return tells us is that there are still 2.6 million acres of untended lands in Ireland, including the domain lands around these country houses, right? So those lands have not been transferred under the Land Acts. And part of the reason for that is so much of this land came into landlords' hands after the passing of the 1881 Land Act. And they were subsequently then let out to graziers and so on the 11 months or the conacre system. So they don't come under the terms of the 1881 Land Act. And it becomes profitable for landlords to allow lands to be let on this basis. So those are the lands that are very much targeted then during the revolutionary period.
Okay, now let's move. Sorry, I can just go back to the question of the Great War, Terence, because
yes.
I interrupted you there. You were explaining about why you have two chapters on the Great War. Let's deal with that.
Okay, so... You cannot look at the history of the decline of the aristocracy from the land war era through to Irish independence without looking at that other great watershed period in their history, which was the Great War. Now, the Great War impacts on the aristocracy on a variety of different levels, social, obviously, political. Physical, if you like, and psychologically. So it's important to understand the contribution that they make to the war effort, and then in turn the contribution that had upon their lives and their lifestyles in Ireland. Now they suffer, huge losses during the Great War. Estimates would suggest that about 80% of Irish landed families had a family participant in the Great War. Around about 25% of those who went to war never returned. And we have, very little work so far on what the state of those who did return was. So the war has, impact on individual families in various degrees. I mean, you have families, for example, like the Actons of Kilmacurra House in County Wicklow, who are very much impacted by the debt of successive heirs at the front, and the debt duties that they have to pay make it impossible for them to continue to manage their estates into the future. So it's generally taken to be a major watershed period in the history of the decline of the aristocracy.
So you're seeing it as part of a long durée, if you like, of decline, right?
Yes.
And that the revolution period is just one episode of that.
Yes, I mean, they're just coming out of the Great War, and they're coming out of all the consequences that the Great War has had upon their lives, when suddenly they're launched then into the Irish Revolutionary period.
And of course, these people would tend to be in the officer class in the war, and they suffered more proportionately. We know that from figures, you know, figures in Britain. Yeah. Okay, Terence, let's move on then to the War of Independence itself right now. Earlier, you mentioned then that there's about a 2-to-1 split, that there's more houses burnt down in the Civil War, which lasted only, you know, less than a year, than in the War of Independence, which lasted for, well, 2.5 years, you could say. Mm. Why is that, right? I mean, we're into the question of motivation now. Why were these houses burnt down? And, like, you know, if in replying, if you could just draw distinctions between the War of Independence and the Civil War, if there are any distinctions, or is it just the same phenomenon?
So when the revolutionary period breaks out, I mean, first of all, there are a series of raids in country houses up and down the country by volunteers who are looking for arms and ammunition, believing that they are well stocked with the same. And very often that wasn't the case. But in the spring then of 1920, when the IRA launched a systematic campaign against RIC barracks in the countryside, they drive the RIC into the larger urban areas, and therefore they have freer rein in the countryside than they might have had under different circumstances. And it is from about February 1920 or so that the first attacks occur on big houses. Now, part of the reason for this in the initial stages, there are military reasons for it, because the RIC is obviously being reinforced by the arrival of the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries. And because they don't have outlying barracks to billet them in, the British authorities begin to look at country houses as substitute billets or substitute barracks. And as rumours begin to escalate that certain houses are to be occupied by the Black and Tans or the police forces, then they are burned by the IRA in order to prevent this from happening. Your typical example would be Summerhill in County Meath, where, you know, Michael Collins receives information that it is about to be occupied by the Crown forces, sends a message down to the Meath IRA under Sean Bylan, who immediately orders its destruction. So there are also other houses that are occupied by the Crown forces that are subsequently burned after they leave, very often to prevent them coming back again. And then as the War of Independence intensifies and it becomes characterized by reprisal and counter-reprisal, many country houses find themselves caught up in this tit-for-tat type warfare. So you will have houses that, like Meidrum in County Westmeath, that is burned as a reprisal for Black and Tan atrocities in Knockcrockery village in Roscommon, following an IRA ambush that had resulted in the death of Colonel Lambert, who the IRA were attempting to take and hold as a hostage for the release of General Sean McGowan. So very many then houses get caught up in this reprisal, counter-reprisal scenario. But the point that I have made quite strongly in the book itself is that what very often might seem to be the most obvious reason for the burning of a house, it's that it's burned as a reprisal or a counter-reprisal, or that it's burned for what loosely might be termed military reasons, often camouflages or hides more local issues related to agrarianism. And again, Meidrum is a very good example in that, because the leader of the gang on the evening of its burning, Thomas Costello, himself and his fellow IRA comrades lay out quite clearly the reasons why they were involved in the burning of the house as a reprisal for local Black and Tan atrocities. But what they don't talk about is the fact that Costello himself, for example, had been involved in local agrarian issues in the 18 months or so leading up to the burning itself. And eventually he would take over part of Maidrum domain in the aftermath. So you have to investigate very, very thoroughly what is happening at the point in time of burning in the locality as well as within the wider national context. And indeed, very often to take into consideration, you know, some of the lingering ancestral grievances that are there that may also have contributed to the targeting of a specific house.
Terence, can I just ask you, what's your definition of agrarianism? I mean, are we talking about like some species of class war?
We're certainly talking about land grabs or right. Land grabbing.
Just a follow-up question, Terence. I get the impression that you seem to be saying in the book that there has been a reluctance both by society generally and maybe even by historians to actually call this out for what it is or to define it for what it is. You know, the class war aspect of the revolutionary period.
I mean, it hasn't. I don't think it has been dealt with to the extent that it requires up until now. I mean, important work by the likes of Gavin Foster in recent times on the social dimension to the revolutionary period during the Civil War is, you know, beginning to bring a good deal of this out. But you see, it's very easy to skim over what might not be or fit with the national narrative up to now. I mean, again, and this is part of the reason I think why the social dimension of the revolutionary period has largely been hidden. You take the seminal journal article that was published by Patrick Lynch back in 1966 as to why there wasn't a social dimension to the Irish revolutionary period. And he asked the question and answers it by saying that, well, the land question had more or less been solved by the Land Acts up until 1903. Now, we've already said earlier in this interview that wasn't the case. But the publication of that particular piece in 1966, of course, coincided with the 50th anniversary of the Easter Rising. And it didn't necessarily fit with the narrative of the time. Now, some historians have picked up on that, of course, obviously picked up on that in the years afterwards. And the likes of Paul Bew, for example, you know, suggested this agrarian dimension to the War of Independence before I did. But it certainly is something that will require a great deal more scrupulous investigation in the years ahead.
Just while it occurs to me, Terence, like what's happening elsewhere in Europe, right? Because, I mean, it would be remarkable if we were immune from this kind of class war and agitation, because it seems to be happening everywhere else.
I'm not an authority on it, but I'm certainly one who is very interested in investigating it in the future. I mean, you know, land reform, land questions across Europe from 1917 onwards. And the extent of the impact that this has on aristocracies across Europe. And I mean, again, and it's not even confined to Europe. I mean, you look at the Mexican Revolution, for example, of 1910. But also, I mean, even much more recently, I came across a book it's the same title of one of the books I have myself. It's The Land for the People. But in this case, it looks at land conflict and agrarian reform throughout Indonesia in the early part of the 21st century. So, I mean, this is by no means unique to Ireland. It's happening across Europe. In fact, it's happening across the world.
Now, just go back to the question I asked earlier, then. When you move into the Civil War, then how do the motivations change, or the alleged motivations change?
Well, again, I think most historians are now in agreement that during the Civil War, significantly more houses are burned for agrarian reasons than would have been the case during the War of Independence. I mean, Gemma Clark's work on violence during the Civil War, concentrating on the Munster counties, Kieran Riley's work on County Offaly, Anna Reardon's work on Ballydugan in East Galway, Glasgow Sims on Capoquin in Waterford, and so on. And I mean, they bring out quite clearly the extent that the rise in agrarianism during the Civil War had on burnings. Now, of course, you're in a situation whereby law and order has more or less broken down in the countryside, or the forces of law and order, are not operating, and therefore, it opens up the countryside to much more violence. But again, I mean, you have a variety of different motivations. So if we can start with the military reasons, what might loosely be termed military reasons. First of all, if you like, the precedence has been set during the War of Independence for the occupation of big houses by the Crown forces. Now they're being occupied by the anti-treatyites and in some cases by the Free Staters. During the truce period alone, I mean, dozens of houses are taken over, commandeered by the IRA, and they're used as training camps. And they're ideal for this, you know, given their size, given the nature of the accommodation that's there, given the nature of the domain that is, you know, very practical in terms of skirmishing, etc. But the anti-treatyites, as they go into retreat, as they leave houses, they burn them. Mitchell Sandcastle and Cork being a very good example of that. You also have houses that are burned because of the fact that they are owned by senators in the new Free State government. Now, these have, if you like, fallen out between the rock and the hard face, because that not only are they the homes of the aristocracy or the former aristocracy, they are now homes of the supporters of the new regime. And as reprisals for the execution of anti-treatyite leaders, these houses become targets. Houses such as Barfield or Capoquin would be two that would come readily to mind. But then you have more widespread agrarianism, and you have more indulgence, like in the attempts to drive landlords out of local communities, or to ensure that they won't return if they have left in the previous few weeks or months or since the beginning of the War of Independence, so that the domain lands can be taken over and redistributed amongst local small uneconomic holders or the landless. I think Tubberd Ailey is probably a very good example. This house is located outside Road in County Offaly. Now, the beginnings of strife or conflict on the estate goes back to about 1917, when there was a labourer strike on the estate. So the first thing that happened there is the landlord, Edward J. Beaumont Nesbitt, I mean, he dismisses a number of his employees because of their participation in labour agitation. Now, some of those who have been dismissed then have later family contacts with the IRA. During the run-up to the actual burning itself, there are several raids in the house. There is agrarian agitation in the locality. E.J. Beaumont Nesbitt eventually is forced to leave the house himself. When the house is eventually burned, It could be argued that there is both IRA involvement and the involvement of local agrarian agitators. But in the reports that follow from the local police, which now the Garda Síochána, then what they are specifically stating is that this is very much related to an agrarian conflict. It is relating to the occupation of the domain lands by some of those who were originally dismissed by Beaumont Nesbitt back in 1917, who have taken over labourers' cottages on the estate and who have taken over parts of the land. And this continues in the aftermath of the passing of the 1923 Land Act, until the Land Commission eventually sorts out the situation there in the early 1930s. And those who had been part of the original agrarian agitation on the estate were instated on the main lands themselves and farms that were provided by the Irish Land Commission.
Now, Terence, you mentioned there the 1923 Land Act, which I suspect many of our listeners may not be aware of. And of course, the date, that's obviously a piece of legislation, one of the first things that the new Irish Free State enacted. So what was happening there?
When agrarian agitation threatened in the early stages of the War of Independence to impact upon the political revolution, the Dáil itself, you know, looked at essentially what was happening, and they realized that something had to be done to quell agrarian agitation. The agrarian agitation then escalates, as we've said previously, during the Civil War. And again, the government decides to take the type of decision that British governments had taken in the past to quell this agrarian agitation through the introduction of a Land Act. And specifically, the 1923 Land Act was aimed at ending the agrarian agitation that had spread from the West throughout the rest of the country. And what it set out to do was, number one, to complete the transfer of land ownership from landlords to tenants. Because again, while about 80% of land or so had been transferred up to the Great War period, there were still significant tracts of land that hadn't. So number one, they had to do that. But secondly, they decided to tackle the congestion problem. So the government was given the power through the Irish Land Commission to compulsorily acquire any untended lands that were necessary for the relief of congestion in an area. So essentially, promises were being held out that when this act was passed, that there would be an acquisition and a redistribution of lands that would go some way towards finally settling the land question in Ireland. Now, of course, that legislation was working in tandem with other legislation that the government had introduced to try to quell rural disorder in general. So it was part of a suite of legislation.
It's a carrot and stick approach.
Carrot and stick approach.
Right.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, when it's at bill stage, I mean, Kevin O'Higgins addresses both houses of the Oireachtas, and he makes the point very strongly that anyone who continues to involve themselves in agrarian agitation in the future will be debarred from the conditions of the 1923 Land Act.
Just a general comment, because we're going to finish up shortly, Terence. Do you think there's been a bit of a narrative that these house burnings were just mindless vandalism and something we should be, you know, ashamed of collectively?
Yes, of course there has been in certain quarters. But, I mean, the whole point of the book was to bring out all of the nuances that are there in relation to the motivations for burnings. And, I mean, it's not... this is a period of revolution, right? It's a period of war. And we've got to understand that as being part of the context. So it's not just mindless vandalism.
Now, we look at big houses differently now. I mean, a lot of people would look at them as, you know, centres of tourism and so on and so forth. But the reality is they were expressions of power, and they were expressions of the conquest, you know, when they were built back mostly in the 18th century, I presume, you know? I mean, they may not be a tower house, like a blockhouse, a castle, you know, a medieval castle, but they fulfill the same function, which is to express power on the landscape.
Yes, undoubtedly. I mean, and they would always be referred to or known as power houses, because, I mean, from those houses emanated the political power as well as the social power, the economic power within local communities and within the country as a whole.
Now, just to wrap up, Terence. I'm just going to wrap up, Terence, on this, because you talked earlier about all the new sources available, the pension files, the Bureau of Military History, and there has been quite a bit of, you know, backslapping self-congratulation about this in the academy. But you've identified one major gap in this whole scenario.
Yes, I agree with you, Tommy. I mean, you know, there has been this fantastic release of primary records, but again, it's a point I made in the Decline of the Big House, another book, The Land for the People, and the same applies here, that our understanding of the revolutionary period, the long revolutionary period, and indeed how the revolution played itself out long after 1923 can only be fully understood when the Land Commission records are released for research. Now,
Why had they not been released, Terence, do you think?
Well, you see, the reason that has always been put forward, Tommy, is that these are working records. And yes, there is no doubt that, you know, a significant proportion of them are working records that are required by legal people and so on a daily basis in order to facilitate conveyancing and so on. But that doesn't mean that all the other millions of records that are there cannot in time be released to the public. Now, what we are getting, we're getting some sense that this is going to happen in the future. I mean, the latest announcement has been, of course, that the indexes are going to be digitized and made available to the public. But if you think about the other records that have been released in relation to the revolutionary period, if we were told that the pension files, the indexes to the pension files are now all available to you, right? But you cannot actually read the files. Yeah. Or it's a bit like giving somebody a book and telling them, you know, you can have access to the index, but you can't actually see what's in the main narrative. So opening them or digitizing the index is definitely a step forward. And it is, you know, a positive step forward. But that's all it is. And until such time as all of the records are opened, then, I mean, we are losing an awful lot in relation to research material for the history of the modern state.
Okay, listen, Terence, on that one, I will let's wrap it up, because you've identified the next area of research, your next book, possibly, when these records are released, or for the generation following you. And certainly this book has teed up this whole question very nicely. Listen, Terence, thanks very much. That was Terence Dooley, author of Burning the Big House, The Story of the Irish Country House in a Time of War and Revolution, just published by Yale University Press. And listeners, I hope you can tune in for the next Head School. Thank you again, Terence.
Thank you very much, Tammy.